Thanks for listening to the Adam Carolla Show on Podcast One. Thanks for listening to the Adam Carolla Show on Podcast One.
Well, we talked to Stone Cold Steve Austin in the first half, so be prepared for that.
For just $25, you get wine and gifts. Ace's favorite stuff or products from ACS. Every single month, you get the drink you choose. It's hard to beat cool stuff and booze. Adam's Monthly Nut. Adam's Monthly Nut.
You heard Dick. A new year of Adam's Monthly Nut hath begun. We kick off 2021 with a bang, with products like a bottle of Promescent Delay Spray to keep you going all year long, a collapsible water bowl to cure feminine canine hydration syndrome anywhere it strikes, a Secret Santa gift, because let's be honest, we got Corolla gifts galore at the warehouse, and a digital download of the first three glorious years of the Ace Awards. The year of the devil is behind us. Get ready for an all-new year of Adam's Monthly Nut. From Corolla One Studios in Glendale, California, this is the Adam Carolla Show. Adam's guest today, Steve Austin, and director Tiller Russell. With Gina Grad on news and Bald Brian on sound effects. And now, on the bright side, last week proved him right about the best home security being a Confederate or don't tread on me flag. Adam Carolla.
Yeah, get it on. Got to get it on. No choice but to get on. It mandates you get it on now. Thanks for tuning in and thanks for telling a friend. We love that about you, right, Gina Grad?
That's right.
Handball, Brian. I want to kill Nancy Pelosi.
Buddy, you can't say
that. Oh, come on. This is not the time for that. You're getting in a lot of trouble.
All right. Well, I had some good news. Max Pat, I think I emailed you a photograph, but I'm not sure if you got that or not. I was walking around, and these days, I've just, well, if you don't have it, doesn't
matter. I got it. It's a different email.
It's these days, you know, it's kind of, I look at graffiti sort of like I look at bumper stickers. You know, bumper stickers used to be a lot of who you wanted to bang and what drug you wanted to do, what band you liked.
They're aspirational.
Yeah. You could take the In-N-Out bumper sticker and make it the In-N-Out Urge. Because it said In-N-Out
Burger. Yeah. Right.
And you just let the world know that you're ready to have sex.
You're down to pound.
You're down to pound and all the gas, grass, and ass and all that kind of stuff. Then there were just the basic bumper stickers. The one that said, I don't know why, but when I was a kid, I always liked the bumper sticker that said, back by popular demand. It was somehow suggested that you... And your Toyota, we're now back by popular demand.
Popular demand.
It's like a high self-esteem bumper sticker. I like that one. I like the one, I wasn't a fan of the series, but there was the Beam Me Up Scotty bumper stickers.
Oh, you like that one?
As though they were traversing the galaxy in their spaceship.
I like bumper stickers. It gave you something to do when you're behind somebody, especially for me, a slow reader. You know, it could take a whole light for me to get through some of those bumper stickers.
Coexist must have given you an aneurysm.
Well, that's kind of what I'm saying. Now it all kind of gave way to something political or some sort of virtue signaling or something, some version of that. You know, now there's a lot of people wanting you to know where they stand politically or where they are with the environment or how they are with their kids, you know, those kinds of things versus being horny or popular.
Right. The weirdest ones are the cars that are plastered with them all over the back. Like, just by virtue of the fact that you have 35 bumper stickers, I know where you're coming from politically. I don't need to know what they say.
Yes. Well, and ironically, you want people to know where you stand and to respect that. The more bumper stickers you have, the less we respect you or listen to you.
We do think you're insane.
Covered in them.
Second you pull behind someone with more than 2.5 bumper stickers, you know this person's insane. It's sort of like the person that's been to Disneyland 26,000 times, you know, and they have all the buttons and tattoos and stuff. Like, you're insane.
Flair.
And then graffiti has now turned into gang stuff, political stuff. It kind of followed the way the bumper sticker. Graffiti used to just be, you know, Kilroy was here or some chick's phone number or something, you know. Now it's taken on a more political thing. But I was walking around about a half hour ago, and I saw graffiti that I have not seen in years. It was just a good old-fashioned cock. Somebody had just drawn the cock with the hairy balls.
Very veiny.
It's got veins. It's got a big hammerhead. It's got the urethra slit in there. And it's just a good old-fashioned dick on the side of the freeway barrier. And I thought, this is, again, I think of it like when you hear about people talking about pickpockets. You know, I go, that's so quaint versus having someone just cold cock you walking down the streets of Manhattan or bash you over the head in the subway or push you onto the tracks. You know, just pickpocket. Quaint.
So if we're trying to explain this to our grandchild or maybe grandparent, we have to say things have gotten so bad that a cock is charming when you see it on the sidewalk.
Yeah.
Does it make you feel less good, Adam, about the cock? That the clearly the two-tone paint, it's been painted over like this is a repeat offender.
Mm.
Like
the,
this
real
is
cocking.
A second tone of paint that the cock is now on top of.
Yeah, somebody tried to clean up. They never get the right shade of paint when they go over the other thing that they painted over. They got the weird gray that's over the white. Not sure why they can't just match the white up with a little Swiss coffee exterior. But either way, I saw a cock graffitied, and I thought for one moment I'd hearken back to a different America.
How nice.
Where, you know.
This is when America was great.
This is Mayberry stuff.
Yeah, people made casseroles. They played with lawn darts. And
they left apple pies on their windowsill.
And they graffitied cocks on the sides of retaining walls going under freeway.
Time.
So it was a better time. Somebody tweeted me today, wanted to know Brian's origin story. And I thought, we haven't talked about Brian's origin story as it pertains to this show for a long time. So I thought, that's interesting. Let's get Brian's origin, if ever. So
I know that you and I did a two-parter taking the years of four or five years ago. We got into it pretty deep, but that's behind a paywall, and, you know, not everyone can access that. So sure, you want to get into it?
Yeah. So Brian, the first time I met Brian, he was working as a phone screener for Loveline. What year did you show up at Loveline? Oh, you showed up at K-Rock first.
Yeah. You and I met probably in 2002, screening calls at Loveline.
Mm-hmm.
The backstory behind that is I finished college in the spring of 2000. And for people who remember that era, that was right when the dot-com bubble was bursting, you know, the whole recession, blah, blah, blah. I actually got a job out of college. I was writing for a website, and that website never actually launched. They were never funded. It was a startup, and I was out of a job in, I don't know, 6 or 8 months or something, and assembled a series of – I hustled. I sent assembled a series of sort of part-time fill-in jobs. That's where I was
secret taste shopper.
Secret shopper, taste tester for Jack in the Box. My territory was like the Diamond Bar Inland Empire area, like Chino, all that stuff, which is not the nicest area.
Emerald City.
Yes, all that stuff. Azusa, all that. So I secret shopper, Jack in the Box. What did I do after? I guess I was doing a bunch of, you know, part-time jobs, and I came across a listing that was like, oh, K-Rock needs phone screeners. And of course, I knew K-Rock had been in L.A. for 5 years. I'm like, oh, that's the cool station. That's the one that plays on the modern rock and has the legacy and everything. So I applied and got called for an interview. And as far as I could tell, because I went in, they were interviewing a bunch of people that day. As far as I could tell, I was the only one who wore a tie and a coat that day. So I
think that should have automatically eliminated you.
That's a good point, but I don't know. They I got the job, so I started screening calls for the flashback lunch at K-Rock and, 80s, whatever, 90s stuff. And after I did that for about a year, like Adam said, half a radio is just showing up on time. I just showed up on time every day, and I guess they deemed me a valuable employee at that point, because when a screening job opened up over at Loveline, they're like, oh, well, Brian's a good call screener. Let's offer him the job. And that was $12 an hour as opposed to $6.75.
I remember. Mm.
So that was big time. That was 2002. I was at K-Rock for 9/11. Not when it happened, but like I had to work that day, and we screened a lot of calls, people asking where they could donate blood and where, they call the radio station because that's very in the moment. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You can't call a news station and talk to people. They called the radio station. 2002 is when you and I met, Adam, probably spring-ish, I'm guessing. I don't remember either.
I remember we had Tara, don't call me Tara, goddammit, screening calls. She was probably screening calls when you were screening calls. You guys probably
overlapped for at least a year or more. Tara's a friend, and Damien is the guy that I took over for. He was on his way out, and so they needed a new call screener.
Do you remember Damien?
He was there for a few days. He was bald. It wasn't much of a transition between him and me, just two bald guys screening calls. But he was there for like 4 or 5 days just to kind of train me. And there's Chubby Brian at the Westwood One Studios.
Yeah.
That's 2002. Look at the computers.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember. I don't remember Damien. I remember Tara just because she settled my hash one night when we got a whole bunch of calls that were all on the same subject and kind of a bummer. Maybe they were like three abortion calls in a row or something like that. And then during the commercial break, I left the studio and went around to where the booth was, the engineering booth, and the phone screeners were. And they're always watching The Simpsons, I think, was up on the TV
set.
That was
being rerun like on local TV during Loveline.
And the TV was like up in the corner on one of those mounts, like up in the wall. And everyone was watching The Simpsons with no sound. And then I came in and I said, hey, we just got three abortion calls in a row. I don't want any more bummer calls. I want a little Casey Kasem. You know, I don't want any more stories about guys who had to put their dogs down. And everyone just kept staring at The Simpsons. And then at some point, Tara, don't call me Tara, started laughing at the TV set in the middle of my soliloquy about not taking the same calls. And then I said, hey, I need your attention. And she said, I can watch TV and listen to you. And I thought, okay. And then I said, well, you know what? Stop watching TV and listen to me. And she said I don't have to. And then I said, I can fire your ass. And she said, you can't fire me. You're not my boss. And I said, yeah, I am your boss. And I could fire you. And I remember, wow, man, she was like 22, maybe 23. I don't even know how old she was. But lest anyone think this stuff is new, this stuff goes back. I mean,
she was right in the sense that you didn't sign her paychecks. But I assume if you had gone to Ann or Kevin Weatherly and said, hey, this part-time minimum wage worker I'm not happy with, they would have made a change pretty quick.
Yeah.
I could have lobbied and maybe could have got something done. I don't know why she wanted to risk that, but she didn't seem to be sufficiently frightened of me coming in there. But that's what I remember. And Bald was, sober and on time. And I was impressed with him. And so when it came time to go do the morning radio show, I think I said, Brian should come with us.
You know what memory just popped into my head that I have not thought about since probably 2003? Wow, this is funny. I literally just thought about this. There was a a period, and it never came to fruition, but I believe it was the genesis of the Adam Carolla show, which was Anne came to me, of all people, and was the producer of the show, Anne Ingold, and said, Adam wants to like incorporate more news stories and like and you know, news of the day, like, and he suggested, this is a meeting you and Drew had with Kevin Weatherly, he suggested that you, Brian, you bring in some news stories and you, you know, read the stories and blah, blah, and this is kind of what morphed into, you know, the show we do today. I never put the pieces together because it never happened, but I was extremely flattered, and obviously that was something you at least had in the back of your mind. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I have a vague recollection of that. Then
this would have been circa 03, 04-ish.
Yeah. I don't think they were talking to me about doing morning radio then.
It was like incorporating it into Loveline.
Yeah, I get that, but I don't think I had my eye on a different show. I love the Loveline schedule, as weird as it was. The majesty of the Loveline schedules, it was Sunday night through Thursday night. So I always had weekends to do whatever I wanted. And Sunday night is kind of a lost night anyway. Like, we work 10 to midnight on Sunday night. You're never doing anything Sunday night, you know, after
you're preparing for work the next
after
day
after 10 o'clock. So I always liked the kind of weird short work week with Sunday. I could do what, you know, you could do whatever you wanted. You could watch all the ball games and drink all the beers. All you had to do is kind of get it together for Sunday night. So I liked that. And I always liked the nighttime schedule. I liked the no traffic on the way in. I liked the no traffic on the way out. I liked the fact that we would always kind of slide under the radar. There was no business in the building. We weren't at K-Rock at the time.
And keep in mind, we were in downtown Culver City, which to people in the LA area now, it's this bustling, you know, hotspot, just restaurants and everything. At the time, you could park anywhere. It was a dead zone for the entire night.
It was completely dead in Culver City at night. There were no restaurants or anything. There was no nightlife. I've told you guys, the one time I went out in Culver City after the show was with Chris Penn, Sean Penn.
You must have gone to the Culver Hotel because there were no other options.
No, it was so
for 100 years.
It was so on point for Chris Penn. He's like, the show ended, and he's like, we should get a drink. And I said, yeah, where? And he said, I know a cop bar.
Oh, that's right. Jocks or Dailies.
Jocks or Dailies.
Yeah. It's a cop bar. That's we can go there and get some beers. And I was like, okay. So that we did. I'm glad we did. When I told that story to Sean Penn, I was like, tell me if this sounds totally on point for your brother. Let's go to a cop bar after the show. And he's like, that's exactly what that guy would have done. Like, that's exactly who he was. Like, you know, you're not making that story up when the brother goes, Sean goes, that's exactly the kind of guy Chris was on a Tuesday night. You know, we're going out after midnight. So we're looking at a picture of Drew and Bald Brian from back in the day.
Producer Lauren?
Producer junior producer Lauren, and I don't know who she's standing next to.
I can't see.
I do. My favorite producer Lauren story of all time is after working with her for like 5 years, I said, so producer Lauren, what have you learned from working with me? And she said, well, you don't have to be prompt. You don't have to be smart. You can talk about whatever you want, and they can never fire you. And it's who you know. That's how you get
the job. She was surely just busting your balls.
Nope. Dead serious.
I don't think Lauren has a ball busting.
No.
She was genuine.
Ironically, did a fantastic job of busting my balls.
That's true.
They can't fire you, and it's who you know. I don't even know how that worked. But they can fire you, and I didn't know anybody when I got the gig. But we digress. So now it's time. Now we move forward to 2006.
Well, I'll color in the broad strokes. Of course, are correct. But what happened was, I was working a full-time job. I was done with the radio. I was working. I was writing for Channel One News, which was the in-school news network. It was like closed-circuited, like into schools. Mm-hmm. That was my full-time. It was a corporate gig. I did that for 2 years after I coached football, after I screened, you know, calls at Loveline. I was like in the corporate world. I got a call out of the blue one day from a guy named Mike Maddox, and Mike Maddox was a producer on Too Late with Adam Carolla, which was the just launched Comedy Central talk show that you were hosting, of course. It'd be weird if someone else was hosting Too Late with Adam Carolla. And Mike's like, hey, Adam, mention your name. I'm producing for this TV show. We need someone to produce this segment where we take calls, basically. I'm like, well, yeah, I can definitely do that. And this is a Thursday afternoon that I get this call. And he's like, yeah, we need you to start Monday. And I'm like, I'm in a corporate job. Like, I can't just, like, leave. Like you know, hey, so long. I'm gone as of Monday. But it was a great opportunity. It was great money. It was certainly more than I was making at the time. And I really wanted to do it. And luckily my boss was very cool about it. I had to go into her office the next morning and be like, hey, I'm really sorry to do this to you, but this is an opportunity I have to take. She's like, I understand. You'd be a fool not to take it. So I produced, segment producer on your show, the phone call segment, with Jimmy's cousin Ivy was my coworker. It was very nice. And that lasted for a few months. Went to the end of 2005, pretty much to Thanksgiving break 2005, and that's when that ended, and that was right when the news was breaking that you were taking over for Howard Stern, blah, blah, blah. You're going to be on KLSX and a few other stations. And I approached you, you know, nervously. I didn't know you that well at that point. After work one day, and I was like, hey, man, I know you're staffing up. I'd love to be a part of the radio show if there's some opportunity. And it was the only job they had open at that point was a call screener. And a lowly call screener is where I went. Yeah, I had experience, and it was a step back. Obviously, that's about as entry level as it gets in the entertainment industry. You know, the PA call screener, that's all very entry level. And I just really wanted to be a part of it. I loved Howard Stern. I was a big fan of yours. Obviously, I knew you, Loveline, all that stuff. And I was like, this is like a momentous occasion in radio history. I want to be a part of it. I want to be there. So I took this, again, minimum wage job. It was hourly. It wasn't even salaried. And jumped on board from day one.
And you screen calls for a number of weeks, maybe months. And
it was 5 months.
And Mike,
there was Cinco de Mayo when I stepped in. Sorry,
Mike Lynch was doing the sound effects. We all know Mike Lynch, but from this show. But he was sort of in studio doing the sound effects stuff. But he was slated to get married, and I think had a 2 week honeymoon planned in Europe. I think
in Ireland.
And when he stepped away for 2 weeks, Brian slid in. And Brian did such a great job with the sound effects and memorizing all the sound effects and everything that when Mike came back, there was no job for him in the sound effects department because Brian had stepped in and proven himself. Mike being the kind of guy that Mike is. There's a picture of us from back in the day.
Holy crap.
He was on his way to burn the building down.
Yeah. Well, Mike, Adam, you can speak to this. Mike was doing double duty. He was the show's writer, the show's lone writer, and also doing the in-studio stuff.
Right. And Mike's kind of a low-key, behind-the-scenes kind of guy anyway, so he didn't need to be in the studio, and I think it just freed him up to do more of his writing job, which he did want to do. So he took it very gracefully and was completely fine with it. I don't think that he ever had an issue with it. I remember being a little nervous about it because we're going to basically tell him that Wally Pipp took his place.
Is Wally other Pipp? Way around?
Oh yeah, that what's his name?
Lou Gehrig
took Wally Pipp's place. But either way, he took it very well as he always does. And he just slid over there, and then Brian was doing the sound effects. And Brian had, like, some sort of gift. I think it's your game show memory. Maybe your trivia game show memory.
Yeah, yeah. People asked, you know, oh, the sound effects, how do you do that? I'm like, I just have a good memory. I remember what everything is called. I remember where everything is, you know, fortunately at the time. Lest you listeners want to go back and listen to some of those shows, I was very green. I mean, I didn't really have any training. I wasn't the polished broadcaster that stands before you today. And I've said it before, and I'll say it again, Adam, you know, you showed me a lot of loyalty in those days. Like, I wasn't a great broadcaster. I was finding my feet. I was, you know, I was going to sound effects, but I wasn't, you know, loquacious and eloquent. And not that I am now, but I'm certainly better. I'm certainly a better version of what I was back then. So thank you for sticking with me all these years.
Yeah, my pleasure. The broadcasting stuff, as Gina will attest, is just reps. And you kind of wonder, yeah, because it's funny when you hear really seasoned broadcasters, you go, wow, that woman or that man is a really good broadcaster. But oftentimes they're not funny. They're not interesting. They're not even, not even the kind of person you'd want to sit next to at a cocktail party or something. But yet, they're such good talkers, and you
realize they're relaxed and they have something to say.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you really, it's so invisible, and it could only be done with repetition that you get really good at speaking into a microphone. And again, you don't have to be engaging or fascinating or funny or anything. It's just such a repetition. Not that Brian isn't all of those things and more, but and I know it sounded like it was going down that road, but it was the reps that were hard to come by. And that's why
there's no minor league. So
no,
not in this situation.
Not here.
And so, like, when I got into radio, I was like, well, there are all these funny guys I know from the Groundlings, from the Acme Theater. These guys do tons of voices and they're super funny and they're great improvisational actors and so on and so forth. But they would always go with the guys from San Diego who'd been there for 13 years or whatever, because those guys had the reps and the repetition. And it only comes with that. And you could take the funniest stand-up or the funniest groundling or the funniest whomever and put them behind the mic, and they just can't keep up until they get those reps. And nobody wants to wait around for them to get their reps. No one's going to give them a year talking into a mic. And I could remember that feeling. Like, I remember doing Kevin and Bean stuff and, like, going out in Manhattan when we were in New York and, like, trying to do a man on the street thing, just setting it up, just going, like, here's who I am, here's where I am, I decided to talk to people. You don't even just realize that just speaking that way and being...
It's unnatural.
It's unnatural. You never do it. You're not having a conversation. You're smoothly doing this. You're attempting to be smooth, and you don't, again, it's all invisible, and you only know it when people are bad at it. When they're good at it, it just feels natural, feels like that's the way everyone talks. But I could remember, like, watching Kevin and Bean, especially Bean, and he was, like, such a good broadcaster, you know, or just the simple act of interviewing someone, like literally just asking them questions or going back and forth, even in a man on the street kind of thing. It was nerve-wracking. It was difficult. And then at some point, that just becomes what you do. You don't really think about it anymore. But I do remember when I was at KLSX, I don't know if the Nasty Man would come on after us, but I do remember walking into the studio.
He predated us.
I was going to say, was he on when you were on?
No, he predated. You were listening to KLSX probably, but he was not on at the same time as us.
Maybe I went to check the studio out before our show went on the air, and the Nasty Man had all these signs up. I mean, literally, like, printed out in big block letters. Your window to the world. I'm the Nasty Man, the man with the tan.
Yeah, lily pads, you know, basically.
Like it just spread out. So if he ever ran out of stuff, he'd just look up and say, I'm the man with the tan from Guam. I think that was his thing. And that's why in radio you have all those sort of catchphrases and isms and all that kind of stuff. But yeah.
They're called crutches.
Oh, they're called crutches. Yeah, get it on, Dawson. Good pull.
Well, and you know, the other thing the three of us have in common, which this does not happen ever, at least to anyone I know. I mean, my dad was in broadcasting for 55 years and had five moves to five different markets. We all started broadcasting in market two.
That's a good
There's
point.
Nowhere to cut your teeth in, you know, Podunk, Indiana, nothing. I mean, we came on and it was showtime from jump.
I started on K-Rock. I started on the biggest radio station in the biggest market, which was K-Rock on one of the biggest radio shows, Loveline. And I remember going, Jesus Christ, I did not get my reps anywhere before this started. And when we started, Ricky Rackman was the host. And so he
had reps.
He was the host. And one of the hosting things is coming out of commercial, coming back to commercial, setting up the guest, you know, back doing the here's where he's from or here's the name of the album and here's where it can be released and so on and so forth. And I was a great talker, but I had no experience in any of that sort of traffic copping stuff. That was a weird time.
And you know what we all have in common, speaking with what Gina said, Dawson too, I mean, is, you know, the advice that you give out a lot, which I think we were doing before you even said, which is we all worked for free or at least very, very cheap, you know, $50 for you and whatever. I was making screening calls at KLSX was probably $14 an hour, whatever, you know, whatever it was. But it was the opportunity, you know what I mean? Like, forget the fact that it was exciting and cool and new and in the spotlight. It was just fun. It was a cool opportunity. I wanted to be there.
Well, yes. And to your point, you know you're in the right you're in the right business for you when they offer you that opportunity and you say, and I'm getting paid?
Yeah,
because that's something I would have done for free. You would have done for free. Yeah. I was call screening for Nelson Salsa in the middle of the night. And then Conway pulled me in to phone screen and produce for him. And I was getting money. I was getting 10, 12 bucks an hour. That was all I needed to know.
I used to always tell everyone sort of on that subject when people would say when I was doing a lot of interviews coming into the morning show and taking over for Howard Stern, people would inevitably ask, like, aren't you nervous or are you sure you want to take over for Howard Stern? I mean, that's, you know, that's pretty big shoes to fill. Are you sure you want to do this, essentially? You know, you have a career. Well, you're going to screw it up. And I would always just say, well, look, Brad Pitt was married to Jennifer Aniston and then they got divorced. Now, would you want to be the next one to bang Jennifer Aniston after Brad Pitt? She's used to Brad Pitt. Now she's got you. That's got to be intimidating. And the answer is it is. But who's going to turn down Jennifer Aniston? And that's the way I looked at it. All right. Stone Cold Steve Austin's going to join us in a minute.
The Adam Carolla Show presents Steve Austin's Birthday Cocktail Party for December 18th. Let's see who's invited. The greatest clown in history, Joseph Grimaldi. The physicist who discovered the electron, J.J. Thompson. Franz Ferdinand is here, and he did not bring a guitar. He brought World War I. And he's followed in by Joseph Stalin. This party's about to get weird. Ty Cobb just showed up. Betty Grable is here. Keith Richards showed up, and he's still alive. Steven Spielberg. Brad Pitt is here. So is Tommy Davidson. Country singer Tracy Byrd. Casper Van Dien. Well, here comes Katie Holmes, Christina Aguilera, and Billie Eilish. Steve Austin is on the Adam Carolla Show.
Wow, that is a hell of a birthday cocktail party, Steve Austin. The show, by the way, Straight Up Steve Austin, new episodes Mondays at 11 p.m. Eastern Time on USA Network. Congratulations on the show, Steve.
Thank you, man. We had a lot of fun making it.
Yeah, I watched your last show or one of your other shows where you brought the contestants out to the Broken Skull Ranch and kind of put them through their paces. That was really enjoyable. What was that one called?
That was Broken Skull Challenge.
Yeah, that was a really fun show to watch. Why a lot of these shows are so good now is instead of taking people and celebrities or whomever and sort of putting them into a format, they're now going to celebrities, guys like Steve Austin, going, what do you like to do? And it's like, I like to fire crossbows. I like to drive dune buggies. I like to drive race cars. I like to do burnouts and Brodies. And they go, fine, do that. We'll film it.
Pretty much. I mean, they pitched me the idea a couple of years ago, and we shot the pilot. They picked it up. It took a while for them to pick it up. And then we got season one in. And so, you know, when you kind of first start doing something, you kind of trying to figure out what exactly it is. And after we did season one, I think going into season two, kind of knew a little bit more about what the show is. And it helped me, obviously, with a few more repetitions. But, man, this is a fun-ass show. You know, we're not trying to, it's not rocket science. It's a couple people out there doing some activities, driving some cars. You're a big car guy, some stuff on water. I can drive any kind of vehicle in the world. And then we do an activity and it turns into a challenge. And so, I hate to call it a job, Adam, but, I mean, it's a job. But, man, I'm having a lot of fun doing it.
What was the submarine? Who was driving the submarine?
Hey, yours truly. That was a sea breacher. And that thing, half speedboat, half submarine. It'll go pretty deep, you know. It'll go about 60 miles an hour. That thing was incredible. I had to learn, you know, each time we do something, I got to go on the day before. We'll go through all the beats. Our guest is not there, but, you know, we got to learn cameras. Everybody wants to get their move down. But it took me a couple hours to master that, and that thing was an absolute blast. I think you'd love riding in one of those or driving one of those.
How deep will that thing go?
A couple of feet. You can get down there pretty good, but then you got to come on back up. And the thing about it, you know, when I was first learning, those things are really, really tight. And when the first one I was learning, well, the guy was teaching me how to do it, so I was riding back. And, dude, it is very tight back here. And when I go, I've had a lot of MRIs in my lifetime, and so normally when I get an MRI, I need something to help me relax. When they shut that cockpit and I was back here behind that dude, I was like, the only consolation I had is that thing is 100% unsinkable. So that was my saving grace. And I said, dude, you're either going to puss out or you're going to man up. So I manned up and then learned how to commandeer the thing and drive the hell out of it.
You start off as a football player. You get into wrestling after football career's over. How did you get into wrestling?
Man, I was working on a freight dock, driving a forklift, and loading heavy boxes in the back of trucks on a freight dock. And we would go down to the Sportatorium. The Sportatorium is a very famous building in Dallas. And I'd watch the Von Erichs, one of the most popular wrestling families ever come out of Texas, along with the Guerreros. But anyway, we'd go down there and throw stuff at the wrestlers and yell at them. And one of the guys had a wrestling school that he opened up. And I'd been watching wrestling since 7 or 8 years of age. So once I saw that going to that school would be a foot in the door, that's when I said, hey, here's how I'm going to do it.
What we were talking before you came on about repetition and about being able to speak into a microphone and how unnatural it is. Obviously, you got the physicality part down. Was it tough to talk at the beginning?
Yeah, I wasn't worth a damn on the mic because I was always a shy kid anyway. And then all of a sudden you get in the business. I mean, you know, when you're the youngest cat in the dressing room and those guys are grizzled veterans, most of them in their mid-30s, it's very intimidating. Some of them have the gift of gab. And also, man, when you're running up down the road and that's your 11 to learn how to talk, to draw people into that building, it becomes an art form. So, you know, over the course of a few years, I learned how to master the mic, but it was not easy for me.
Tell us some of the horrible gigs you played and how little you were paid at the very beginning.
Man, I remember wrestling one time in a Chevrolet dealership in Dallas, Texas, getting suplexed in the parking lot, not in the ring, in the parking lot. And normally I got the pay stubs to prove it. When they shipped me to Tennessee or when I drove my 1988 base model Hyundai Excel to Tennessee for that territory, I was making either $15 or $20 a night, and those are all 400 miles round trips, coming and going. So you starve.
$15 to $20 a night.
I'm going to cover the gas one way.
No, that's why you got three guys in the car, and they're veterans. And while they're stopping at McDonald's, I would just stay in the car with my thumb up my ass because I couldn't afford anything, and I wasn't going to take no handouts. So it's rough. You pay your dues, and then maybe later you'll make some money.
When did it start? When did the plan come together of sort of climbing up the ranks? Like, I never know. Do they pick you? Do you pick them? Like, how does it work where you get the nod to start becoming the world champion?
Man, it's based on a lot of things, you know, like what you look like, what you talk like, how you can wrestle. Or are you just charismatic and just a giant? Different keys will unlock the lock. And so everybody has a different key. Some people have the same key or the same blueprint. And if a company sees, hey, man, this guy, we can get along with him. He can draw money. He's easy to deal with. Man, he's hard to deal with, but he's really good in the ring and on the mic. So it's kind of like being that player in the NFL, you know, like you can be really, really good and be somewhat of a headache, and they're going to put up with you. Or you can be the greatest guy in the world and also draw money, and they'll love you.
Seems to me like the guys who really conquer the globe are kind of guys like The Rock, who sort of do everything. Like, they have the right look, they can talk, but also total professional businessmen, you know, never cross people. Don't, you know, we all know the NFL version of this. Where, like, I don't know, Terrell Owens or something like that, where you're this incredible physical specimen and you're amazing, but eventually you're poison in the locker room and the team is just going to part ways with you. Yeah. Do you remember early thoughts of The Rock? Do you remember? Did you? Yes. Sorry.
Brian. No, go ahead and finish this line of questioning, because there's a guy I want to ask about who is that kind of locker room poison, but I want to hear about The Rock first.
Oh, no. When he came in, you could see there's a blue chipper. Played football down at Miami, third generation. So when he came in, you could see, you know, right off the bat when you walk in the room, good looking dude, tall guy, big. And it turns out he could also work. You know, took him a while to put it together, and they booed him out of the building for a little bit. But when he kind of turned heel there for a little bit, when he came up with The Rock, all the pieces came together, because he had the looks, he had the size, he had the ability, but he didn't have the right gimmick. And he hadn't put it all together yet. And then he put his promo together yet. When he did all that and turned to The Rock, that's when he started ringing the cash register.
Brian?
So what I was going to bring up, I'm a big wrestling fan, Steve, from back in the day. And the guy who was dynamite in the ring, just a magnetic personality, but maybe had questionable mic skills, but eventually worked himself out of the business, is the Ultimate Warrior, who, of course, was a superstar for a short period of time. They even made a documentary called The Self-Destruction of the Ultimate Warrior. Like, he was just, apparently, maybe you knew him, obviously I don't, he was just impossible to work with. He made it very, very difficult to get along with, or even, like, you know, put on a show. Do you have any experience with him?
No, well, yeah. You know, I remember his career way back when he started with Continental, USWA, and went through Mid-South. He came through Dallas, Texas as a Dingo Warrior. Hell, I was there in the crowd watching him. And he always had that great look, charisma, size, and star power. Now, I can't speak to his business dealings. You know, I've heard sometimes it can be difficult to work with. I can say that, you know, I remember at WrestleMania 12 in Los Angeles, California, many, many years ago. Hell, I was dressing right beside him. The guy was always top-notch to me. But, you know, different guys operate different ways. And I heard he could be difficult. Everybody kind of knows that. But, you know, if you can draw money and put people in seats, you know, people, you know, you'll get
forgiven.
More chances.
Yeah, sure.
Maybe this is even more for Brian than Steve. I don't know. Did the Iron Sheik sort of go nuts? And where is he today?
Steve, I'll set you up. They had made a documentary about him, which of course was very compelling and really well done. His social media presence is a lot more other people, you know what I mean, putting that on than it is him. He's a great personality. Steve, take it away, please.
Talking about the Iron Sheik?
Yeah.
I believe he's still around. I never did pass. Sheik is one of the tough shooters. He's one of the toughest guys in the business at the time. And, you know, if you're going to get crossways with him, he's probably going to come out and lose then. He was known as being a real tough guy, very, very eccentric. I never traveled with him, never worked with him. But, I mean, there's more legendary Iron Sheik stories than probably there are of anybody else in the business. And from what I understand, you know, he could be an interesting guy to hang around with.
There's I know Goldberg a little bit, and Goldberg is still traveling and doing wrestling shows and going to places like in the Middle East and that kind of stuff and making some pretty good paydays. Is there any wrestling in your future? Will you go back on a card? Is your body? I mean, you look to be in great shape, but I don't know how the pain. I don't know the pain in the joint level. How is that for you?
Man, every day I feel good through all the surgeries and all the things I put my body through. I feel pretty good. I ain't got nothing to complain about. As far as getting back in the ring, when I retired in 2003, whenever I had my last match with The Rock at WrestleMania 19 many years ago, was my last match. You know, I'd certainly go back and do an appearance, this, that, or whatever, but I have no designs, no desire to get back in the ring in a wrestling capacity. You know, I want people, for myself, I want people to remember the same Stone Cold Steve Austin they saw back then, and I don't want to go back and be 80% of him, 85% of him, or 75% of him. If I can't be that guy 105%, I don't want to do it. And it took me a long time to get the business out of my system because I didn't want to retire. You know, there's just some nerve issues in my neck, and I pulled the plug on my career. So I'm over it. I'm done. I'm retired. In that line of work, I continue to do the things that I do. So when people say, oh, yeah, you're retired now. No, I do a lot of things.
I saw on the promo when I was watching the trailer for Straight Up Steve Austin, the new episodes Mondays, 11 p.m. USA Network. I saw our friend Joel McHale on there. What was Joel driving?
Well, he came up. It was a Toyota Land Cruiser. What was it? It was badass. The guy that from, I don't know if it was Icon or the other.
Yeah, Icon. Yeah, okay. That's Joel's car, I guess, right?
Yeah, so. Yeah, he just had that thing completed, and he showed up in that thing. And I'm a car guy as well, so that thing was beautiful. I know he just got that new Porsche 911 as well.
Turbo.
Joel's awesome, yeah. Man. You know him because he can stand up, he can host, he can act, he can do it all. And that guy is lightning quick on his feet, and that's what I like. So hanging out with him, like anytime you ask a question, he's got something for you. You don't know which way it's coming. Joel McHale's super quick.
Yeah, I completely agree.
He's an athlete.
He loves cars.
He's got the athletic pedigree.
And he's he's an athlete. All right. Again, Straight Up Steve Austin. It's new episodes Mondays, 11 p.m. Eastern, by the way, on USA Network. Where are you? You out in Nevada?
Yeah, I got to get out in Nevada right now.
How far out of Vegas are you?
No, you're thinking down south. I'm northern Nevada, down from Reno.
Oh, yeah.
Not too far from Lake Tahoe. It's a little bit nice. I mean, well, Vegas is really nice, but I like it out here. It's a lot more quiet. And as you know, most of Nevada's public land. So yesterday I loaded up my buggy, my side-by-side. We got about 65 miles in. So I ride just about every day out here, get my workouts in, and do the things I'm doing. I'm still doing voiceovers, but northern Nevada's pretty spectacular.
Yeah, beautiful country. Steve,
thanks. We should all aspire to have Steve Austin's life now, not just back in the heyday. I mean, killing, hosting, doing all this great shit, having all the great cars. That's awesome.
I think Goldberg moved out to Texas and got a ranch. And I think it seems to be the new world order. Go out somewhere, get some land, get a little freedom, get your vehicles, build a huge garage and enjoy the second half of your life. Good to talk to you, Steve.
Hey, man. Good talking to you, Adam. I love you.
Love you. All right. Steve Austin, Stone Cold Steve Austin. Website, I should say, BrokenSkullRanch.com is where you go if you want more info on that.
Broken Skull Ranch, way more badass than Spawn.
Yeah.
If we're talking how scary something sounds.
Tiller Russell has a documentary. It's a four-part docuseries on the Night Stalker, which I lived through out here, and I remember that. I remember
you
that time very,
survived.
Very clearly. Yeah, Richard Ramirez. So we'll talk to him. We'll do that in a moment. First, let's see. What else has Tiller Russell? What other docs has he done?
Buddy, I'm legit excited for Tiller Russell because he made. I'm not exaggerating. One of my favorite documentaries of all time called Operation Odessa. That is on Netflix right now. I recommend it to everyone. It is 100% on Rotten Tomatoes, which is incredible considering what it's about. It's like about like the Russian drug trade, Russian Colombian drug trade in like the 80s. Like, it's just not that kind of important documentary, you know, they don't normally like heap praise upon. It's spectacular. I love it, and I'm excited to talk to him about it.
Well, we'll talk to him, and we'll talk to him about the Night Stalker. Is Ramirez, he was sentenced to the death penalty, died in 2013 at age 53. Good.
Cancer.
Yeah, just a really scary time in Los Angeles. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll talk to Tiller Russell right after this.
Hey, movie lovers, who needs a theater when you have Pluto TV? Grab your popcorn and your streaming device because free movies are here. Pluto TV is your home for movies. Great movies are playing anytime in over 20 exclusive movie channels of action, horror, rom-coms, and more. Watch hits like Saving Private Ryan, Pretty in Pink, and Charlie's Angels all for free. No signups, no fees, no contracts. Ever. Download the free Pluto TV app on any device.